in order to amplify some principles that are very necessary with regard to how we behave ourselves, and especially in the field of romance. Solomon is a cad. He is arrogant. He has all of the assets necessary to be attractive to a woman without doctrine. The Shulamite, of course, doesn't qualify in that area. She has a great deal of biblical information. She knows how to conduct herself around others. And more importantly, she knows how to defend herself when other people are not behaving. Solomon is not. He thinks of himself as quite the brilliant firer of pickup lines, most of which apparently have been very successful for him. But she is not in any way deluded by these. And so we stop to take a look at the heritage of the privileged class. It is important that believers understand that they are superior to all others in the human race. And I don't say that in any way to elicit from you elitism or to elicit from you arrogance. It's just fact. And properly, those who are aristocrats assume their position with a great deal of responsibility. In the world, and we use the world's definitions and then made application to biblical aristocracy. But in the world, if a person is truly an aristocrat, someone who has either earned or inherited great position in society, and therefore have great financial power, great personal influence, they have a great number of assets available to them. If they are truly humble people, then they take the wealth and influence and provisions that they have, and they use it for the betterment of society. And this is drawn from an inventory of grace orientation. And especially if they're believers, they can have great historical impact that will go on for generations. Now, one of the problems today is that those who are and could be classified by the world as aristocrats do not have the spiritual inventory to have meaningful impact. All of the efforts that they do is based on human viewpoint and human good. It usually causes more trouble than the problems it seeks to solve. But nevertheless, there is this concept that is out there. It is based on chivalry, which was developed back in medieval times. Emerging from that was an appreciation for women and how they should be treated. And there was competition for the ladies. The idea of holding them up on a pedestal and respecting them because they are the weaker vessel, as the Bible puts it. They are the responder, and that's what makes them weak, by the way. And they're wired that way. They can't help but be responders. And the men are the aggressors. And those who aggress, in essence, have power over those who respond. And therefore, those who are the aggressors are the ones who have the responsibility to control social situations. And if you have integrity and you have honor, and therefore you're a person of principle, virtue, then you are going to conduct yourselves appropriately in social situations. And the ladies, therefore, as responders, can respond to virtue rather than the kinds of things that Solomon is firing at the Shulamite. And we therefore sought to describe and illustrate and define these things in a spiritual context, and to show that the believer in Jesus Christ has a human spirit which no one else possesses. Unbelievers don't have that. The human spirit is the target for biblical instruction. And with that biblical instruction, you can grow in grace and you can acquire information that the unbeliever does not possess. You possess, or have the capability of possessing, infinite divine thought. It is based on the righteous standards of God. They are therefore absolutely correct and right. And when you have these thoughts in your soul and you use them to make decisions, you're making good decisions from a position of strength. And when decisions are made from a position of strength, it broadens your future options. And therefore, great prosperity comes to the person who is able to think on a level above the mundane. And thus, you are aristocrats. You have privileges others do not have. You have assets others do not possess. You have knowledge that others cannot acquire or attain. And this elevates you above all the rest. And with that comes great responsibility. And that responsibility is not to be an elitist regarding all of this, and it's not to be arrogant about it, but to desire to offer this phenomenal mentality, opportunity, and future to those who do not have it. And that comes in the area of evangelism, so that these people will have the same equal privilege and equal opportunity that you have to acquire this lifestyle, this environment of soul, and this future. And so to reach out to others who do not have the information is your obligation and your responsibility. It is up to them, after they believe in Christ, as to whether they want to devote themselves to the drudgery of boring Bible classes so they can acquire the information. But if they will stick with it, they will be able to start thinking on a level that is beyond that is normally presented in the devil's world. And those with PhDs are reduced to stupidity by comparison to a person who is a spiritually mature individual. For your level of analysis, your ability to discern deception, your ability to analyze facts as they come in is superior to that of all others. So this is a wonderful environment to own and possess and enjoy. And this is what we've been defining over the last several Bible classes. How to conduct yourself in society, how young men are to conduct themselves before young ladies and vice versa. The Shulamite was standing fast on doctrine. She's using biblical problem-solving devices. Solomon is in the depths of reversionism, as he describes in detail in the book of Ecclesiastes. In one portion of Ecclesiastes, he takes up the period of time that he was in sexual degeneracy. He thought that sex would make him happy. And therefore, he delved into a thing called harem. And he had over 1,000 women that he co-opted in that endeavor. It did not bring him happiness. And so he writes an entire book about his frantic search for happiness, which is Ecclesiastes. But he thought so much of one woman he ran into along the way during his sexual arrogance that he was moved to write poetry. And it's developed in a 5-act play. We're presenting it to you as an opera, which is an anachronism, but it is a teaching aid. I obviously hope you understand. And as an opera, we're presenting this poem to you. And we are moving along quite well. We're actually past halfway through. And we've just noticed Solomon reduce the conversation to that of crass as he begins to move into compliments, which are true. He hasn't said anything to the Shulamite that isn't true. But his intention is to wear her down to where she becomes self-centered and therefore enamored by the fact that he sees such beauty in her that she will say, oh, he is such a fine, glorious man. I want to be with him. And then it's all over. That's his objective. That all he's after is her body. All he wants is to have sex with her. And he'll say anything that he can think up in order to convince her that he's the guy she needs to be with. She sees through it all. But when he finally got around to talking about her sexual assets, she interrupts in Song of Solomon 4:16 with another problem-solving device. And it reads as follows in a paraphrase. Awake, shepherd lover. Well, where is he? He's tending his flocks up on Sharon Plain, which is to the north of Israel. Come south and be caused to aggressively approach my garden. The garden has to do with the Shulamite sexuality. And Solomon has just announced that he plans to seize that shortly. And her desire is not for Solomon, but for the shepherd. And therefore, her desire and her mentality is that the shepherd would come south and seize her garden. If anybody's going to be seizing any gardens around here, let it be the shepherd. So she is having this imagination going on in her soul as a problem-solving device. Come south and be caused to aggressively approach my garden and entice my passions and desires. May my beloved come and enter his garden and enjoy its enchantments. Then we moved into a continuation of Acts 3, chapter 5, Song of Solomon 5:1, and this always introduces it with a New American Standard. And for those of you who have forgotten the color code, for those of you who print out your notes in color, some do that, the color code is as follows. KS is for King Solomon, and he's in blue. The Shulamite woman is SW, and she's in red. We're going to run into the shepherd lover again fairly soon. It will be in a memory trace of the Shulamite. She will remember back on an occurrence that they enjoyed. It had a nice beginning, but a very poor ending. And she will learn from that, and she's going to apply that to her confrontation with Solomon. I've got him in brown. We haven't met the jealous queen yet. She's in sort of a real angry-looking green here. The DJs, the Duwars, standing in the corner, they're just sort of dark green. We've met the Jerusalem guard and the bystanders at Jerusalem, and yet some others to meet. But these are the main characters at the top. And we see that that King Solomon is speaking in verse 1. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Now, that sounds like he's about to have a feast of some kind, but it is all innuendo. It is designed by him to describe her sexual assets without being point blank about it. So he's a smooth operator. He doesn't just come right out and say in a very crass way what he thinks of her assets and what he intends to do. He has all these flowery things to say about it. And we therefore worked on that, and we've come up with a translation and paraphrase. Verse 5, beginning at verse 1a, where we've just read, here's how it really sounds if you break it down, and we've done that. I'm making my move on my garden, my Jewess, my wife. I harvest your sexual delights, which are as the perfumes of myrrh and balsam. I take you completely, your honeycomb as well as your honey, your wine as well as your milk. Now that has to do with the fact that he intends to totally possess her. He's called her his wife yet again, and he intends to possess her physically, and he intends to do it that night. So she understands exactly what he's saying. Now, there's this coterie of coquettes, I call it. These are the daughters of Jerusalem, or the virgin recruiters. We've met them all the way back in the first chapter. And they pipe up with a doo-wop ditty that reads like this. Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. The translation of that is, go for it, both of you. Partake of sensual pleasures to the extreme, O lovers. So their job is to help recruit this woman into the harem. And it is Solomon's intent not to keep her a virgin very long, but to make her his wife. He continuously refers to her as my wife. And that, of course, opens the door to a great deal of discussion, for it is there that Solomon is going to find himself running up against a stump, because in that particular arrangement, she is not going to be able to cooperate. She will be delivered, by the way, by the shepherd before it gets that far. Well, you've got the translation. I've given it to you, but now we need to work it out. We resume at page 2439. Now, I do have to make a brief announcement for those of you that have pre-class notes. There's an error in page numbering beginning on document 236. That first page should be 2441, and on 237 it begins on 2451. That's been fixed. The corrected documents have been emailed to you, and you can get them when you get home. Okay, we're at this second phrase here in Song of Solomon 5:1. The daughters of Jerusalem, the virgins, from the New American Standard, eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. Point one. Discernment enables the believer to analyze the motivations of those they encounter. What people say to you may be one thing, but what they mean is another. And with doctrine, you'll be able to figure that out. In fact, I think political campaigns are excellent test grounds for that. When a politician gets up on the screen and starts saying things and it sounds just wonderful and glorious, your job is to figure out what they're really saying. And the first principle to keep in mind is they're lying. And so when guys start out on you, remember the first principle, they could be lying. And at the same time, they could be telling the truth. But if they're telling the truth, why are they telling the truth? What are they up to? What do they want? Where are they going? So distrust is not what I'm promoting here. Discernment is what I am promoting. Discernment enables the believer to analyze the motivations of those they encounter. Many people are as righteous as the wind-driven snow, and that's for you to determine. Often when a group of people band together in unison to support an idea, they're driven either by ideology or by intimidation. Now, there's a lot of ideology out there today, and the evil side of it is progressive ideology. And one of the major, let's call it sections, one of the major divisions of their canon is sex education. And so young people are trained in the sex education arena, and sometimes the way they behave toward others is based on what they've learned in that curriculum. And so you have to understand that they have been brainwashed to that degree. Know that and adjust to it, that you are driven either by ideology or by intimidation from others. Now, if by ideology, then the motivation is crusader arrogance. If by intimidation, then the motivation is obsequious compliance. And here we find the latter as the daughters of Jerusalem suck up to Solomon. They don't really care whether they get together or not, but they've been given an assignment and they know they very well better do it. And so at the proper times, they pipe up and they sing over in the corner. And what they sing is an encouragement for the Shulamite to accept the shepherd's proposals. So we have this problem of either intimidation or ideology. Now, if by ideology the motivation is crusader arrogance, and crusader arrogance is defined as self-righteous arrogance with strong or impulsive desires to superimpose one's opinions and principles on others without their consent. So much of this goes on in education today. Parents do not want certain things taught to their children, yet they are. Over parental complaint. And it is said that this is necessary because all children don't have proper guidance, and the school therefore has imputed to itself the responsibility of guiding the little children. And what they're guiding the little children into is a heart of hell. And therefore, when you send your children to school, you need to understand there's an ideology that is infused in the curriculum that is designed to have your child accept, without question, progressive ideology. Now, you can go to the public schools if you have doctrine, and you can learn the core courses there, reading, writing, and arithmetic. I think they still have that. You can learn these things while ignoring the rest. You can do the dance. But if you don't have the doctrine, it's very difficult to do, if not impossible. But the crusaders are there, and as they populate the public arena, they have a very self-righteous arrogance. And the arrogance is designed to superimpose one's opinions and principles upon others without their consent. In another time, that would be called propaganda and brainwashing. Now, obsequious compliance. This refers to the daughter's submission to Solomon's assignment to help recruit the Shulamite into his harem as his wife. Started out recruiting her as of a possible virgin. The virgins are the daughters of Jerusalem, among the virgins. There's several of those. And she is a candidate for that at first, but then he decides later on that she's going to be his wife. He begins to call her his bride, his wife. And therefore, he has her targeted for the bed that evening. He is going to consummate this thing as soon as possible. And so, who are these daughters of Jerusalem that have signed on as propagandists singing in the corner? Well, they are in obsequious compliance with the desires of Solomon to recruit this woman. They are the virgins who for the moment have the duties of doing odd jobs around the palace and doing his bidding when given special assignments. And this group has a special assignment to recruit her. Now, this goes on in life. There are those who are called matchmakers and want to try and get people together that they think would be cute. And it's nobody's business who gets with whoever. That is the Holy Spirit's job. The Holy Spirit decides who is together. That has been determined in eternity past. And if people get out of the way, then He can therefore bring people together at the proper time and at the proper place. And you don't have to have a coterie following people around, encouraging and motivating them to get together with someone they've picked out that they think would be cute for them. But their task is to influence the Shulamite into becoming a queen. You think that would be a pretty good lure right there. How would you like to be queen, not for a day, darling, but from now on? And they're trying to promote that. She, in turn, though, is not persuaded by any of their encouragements or by Solomon's lines. She is a very brilliant woman. She has doctrine. She is not easily swayed. This is the mentality. This is the steel of soul that needs to be possessed by every young lady in this congregation and those who listen on the internet. Nevertheless, the daughters have been instructed to recruit the Shulamite, and they subserviently comply. And Solomon asserts his intentions in no uncertain terms, and the daughters voice their approval. Girls do this to each other. Boys egg each other on. And the question emerges as to why. I can tell you this. I can't speak for the ladies. I've heard that their approach sometimes by rumor. But with regard to the guys, the boys think that it is a rite of passage to talk some girl in their school, and sometimes it doesn't really matter who, just talk any of them into having sex with them. And that seems to give them a rite of passage. And then they'll talk about that. And I'm not making this up. I've heard these discussions. And then the guys who are still virgins are looked down upon because they're either considered to be sissies or homosexuals because they don't have this desire to violate some woman's privacy. And then they believe they're less than manly if they don't join in with this thing, so they become hound dogs trying to see if they can find some vulnerable lass around that they can abuse. And then the ladies, on the other hand, I'm told, sometimes identify a guy that is supposed to be hot, and then they all band together to see who can be the one to attract him. And before you know it, the high school turns into a brothel. But there are those who stand around and say, I've got standards and principles, and they're not bending, and I am not going to become involved in this, and I don't care what people think about it. That's a person with iron in the soul. That's a person with doctrine. That's a person that can look down on the other people who claim that they're now the most popular in school and decide that they're the ones who need help, and therefore grace orientation becomes your motivation toward these people. They can recover. There are ways to get past this idiotic idea, and that is through salvation first, Bible class second, and a lot of use of rebound. And the soul can be restored, it can be amplified, it can be modified. And a person can advance and become a person of great honor and integrity. It's not unusual for these things to happen among that age group, but there are those who get over it, but also there are those who never enter into that arena. So, why do they have these discussions? It is because that usually people of that age have no reasonable self-esteem. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know that when you go into the classrooms today, the whole issue is to get self-esteem. Everything is about your self-esteem, but it is a facade. The self-esteem that these kids possess is a facade that is usually backed by arrogance. There is no true humility in the souls of these people. They're building a self-esteem that is pseudo. true self-esteem is based on an understanding of divine thought and therefore the courage to apply it under pressure. Confidence and courage is true self-esteem. And that is only built by understanding the Word of God and then applying it under pressure. And so these conversations do go on, but you do not need to be intimidated by them. Now, the daughters of Jerusalem encouraged the Shulamite to agree to the union that Solomon infers he will consummate that evening. So you can see that pressure she's under. This is pressure. And she has doctrine in the soul, therefore she has integrity built on truth. And now that integrity is placed under pressure, and is she going to be a person of probity? In other words, will she demonstrate integrity under pressure? And she is doing so consistently, and when she does, it is going to be viewed by us. We are the outside observers looking in on this. We will see that she is a woman of honor. But honor is the outward reflection of inner integrity that has been subscribed to, that has been adhered to under pressure. Therefore, probity is the link between integrity and honor. Probity is active integrity. It is integrity that has been placed on the line and you have decided to stand fast with it and apply it. And it comes out on the other side as honor. So their choral accoutrement to his comments uses metaphors for sexual union. So the phrase reads this way in chapter 5, verse 1. I come to my garden, my Jewess, my wife. I gather my myrrh along with my balsam. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. And then the daughters pipe up and sing, eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers, as if they were. The paraphrase, King Solomon. I am making my move on my garden, my Jewess, my wife. I harvest your sexual delights, which are as the perfumes of myrrh and balsam. I take you completely, your honeycomb as well as your honey, your wine as well as your milk. In other words, I possess you totally. That's what that's saying. And now I'm asking you ladies, if you were in a similar situation, would you call that pressure? Her right man is not there, but his presence in her soul is the thing that enables her to maintain soul tranquility under all of this. Therefore, here is an issue for the young ladies to understand. Even if you don't know who your right man is, you have one. You do not need to worry about, am I going to have a man? Am I going to get married? Will this ever happen for me? You don't have to worry about that. You do. God knows it. That person is being prepared for you. The question is, are you preparing for that person? Your obligation is to become a right person and let God take care of who your right number is. You will be introduced at the proper time. And whenever incidences occur where passions and desires are excited, you can defend your soul by remembering that principle. I don't have to go there. I don't have to impress anybody. I don't owe anybody anything. Who I owe something is the Lord Jesus Christ, and I owe Him patience. The Shulamite, therefore, is not deluded by Solomon's glamour. Today, it's hard for me to catch the glamour on some of these glamorous people, but I'm told it's there. I'm too old to understand present-day glamour, I guess. I like Ingrid Bergman. That's my idea of glamour. And especially in some of the movies she was in. There are others. I remember I thought Yvonne DiCarlo. I thought that she was gorgeous. And that woman that was in, played Scarlett O'Hara, Vivian Leigh. Interestingly enough, did you know that there were 23 people were considered for the role of Scarlett O'Hara, and Vivian Leigh was a Brit that happened to be friends with a director, and he decided she was the best one, and she got the part? You wouldn't believe the women that would lined up for that role. But 23 of them, and Vivian Leigh got the part. And you're thinking, well, she was the perfect Scarlett. And I don't know how she understood how to speak like a Georgian,
being from London and all, but she did. But the point is, she was glamorous. Scarlet was glamorous. And the boys all liked Scarlet until they found out underneath the facade was a really mean woman. So the Shulamite is not deluded by Solomon's glamour, which is abundant. The daughters do not grasp why the Shulamite would not fall head over heels for the king. They did. They don't understand why she does it. Why do women not fall for glamorous guys? There are glamorous guys everywhere you go, no matter what circumstance it is. Take a high school, for example. There are glamorous guys in there. There are glamorous girls in there. And they're identified. And usually they turn out to be some kind of deal, like homecoming queen or king and that kind of thing. Or they're voted this, that, or the other thing. And the girls all decide who the hot guys are and vice versa. All of these things are known. The glamour. And therefore, you're attracted to the physical. And that, therefore, is simply attractiveness. So what do you do with that? So you're guy A and you walk up to glamorous girl B and you say, "Hi, darling, how would you like to go out, say, for a latte?" And she says, "Okay." And then you go to that place, that Starbucks outfit, and you get all supplied with a couple of lattes. And you're sitting around the table doing the deal, drinking this really expensive coffee. You'd get a better price at Denny's, by the way. But anyway, you're sitting around drinking this really expensive coffee. And you find out that inside her soul is a great big vacuum that has sucked in a lot of goo. And that if you were to take what's in her soul and have it somehow come outside, and then what's outside somehow be folded inside, she would have a beautiful soul, but you couldn't look at her. You know what I'm saying? So where's your glamour there? So glamour is in the area of attractiveness, but when you get into a person's soul, you find out whether they're really pretty or not. Sometimes they're just ugly as a mud fence. So they don't understand why she's not interested in Solomon. You talk glamour, you don't know glamour until you talk this guy. Everybody knows. He was known from the known world at the time. He was known what we would call all over the Middle East. Sheba came up. The Queen of Sheba came up to visit him because she had heard so much about him. She wanted to see this guy. He owned everything, had more money than God, had more wives than you can imagine, ships, imports, exports, gold, you name it, he had it. Great influence. He could be great Secretary of State. He had all of these deals cut with all of the nations around him. He was just a phenomenal politician. He was obviously a great writer, a great poet. He was a great leader. There's nothing about Solomon that's not glamorous. And on top of all of that, he was a stud muffin. So why? They don't understand. Why is she not taking the deal here? They don't get it. He is dynamic, he's brilliant, he's handsome, and he is wealthy. He is erudite on a multiplicity of subjects and is considered by almost every woman to be the catch of a lifetime. But Solomon's romantic prowess is of no interest to the Shulamite. His well-practiced phrases that praise her physical beauty do not cause her to become self-centered. Guys can tell you the absolute truth, but with an evil intent. His bold confidence that he will bed her is ignored as arrogant bloviations. People bloviate. And when they do, you need to know it. Bloviations have to do with just spouting off whatever you think a person wants to hear and make it grandiose. Make it sound so good that they would just fall for it. If a girl is nice looking, then paint her as Miss America. If she's Miss America, then she becomes Miss Universe. Whatever it takes, just keep going. In fact, Solomon's erotic musings bore her. See, it's boring when you know that there's no real feeling behind it. No honesty. It's all about him, not her. He wants to possess what he thinks he likes, and he has the power to do it, he thinks. One thing that used to amaze me were people who were dating, and the boy would tell the girl what she could and couldn't do. I thought, who are these people? First of all, they think they can order folks over whom they have absolutely no authority around. And who are these airhead girls who think they have to follow his orders? Now, this is stupid to me. Now, I understood the right man, right woman concept. My mother used to talk to me about my right number. I don't know how she came up with this. It must have been the Bible. I'm just guessing. But she used to tell me I had a right number. And I believed that. And I understood the concept that a man and a woman get together and that my dad was the authority in the household. But he was the most gentle, kindest man you've ever seen. But when he came to the final decision, it was Speed Griffin that made the call. So I got all of that. And I couldn't see, you're not married to her. Why do you think you can boss her around the way you're doing? Telling her who she can and can't talk. I saw you talking to Fred today. You can't be talking to him. And I would have thought she'd have said, well, who do you think you are? God? I'll talk to whoever I want to. You ever heard of the First Amendment? How about I use the Second Amendment on you? So I didn't get that. And there's some thing about dating where imputed into it is the idea of marriage. And in my view, and I'm not telling you that you shouldn't date. You have to hear me out here. But dating gets to be very dangerous when the people involved in it do not have principles upon which to function. And they function on emotion, and a lot of that is based on arrogance. Now, two people get together. Girl gives him a lavalier, and the boy gives her a ring. He also gives her an 8x10 glossy photograph suitable for framing of him in his football uniform. And she in turn will give him a picture of her, 8x10, glossy, suitable for framing, of her in her cheerleader outfit. And they have it at home. And they have rings, they have lavaliers, they have all these little keepsakes that they accumulate. And all of a sudden, after maybe a year has passed, they decide, you know, you're pretty attractive, but there's no compatibility here, darling. And so they decide to break up. But you don't just break up. You sort of get mad to have this face on like I'm upset. What's wrong with you? Oh, nothing. I'm fine. And that goes on for a while. And then finally it's decided that, well, hey, we're just, the feeling is not there anymore. So what do? Well, the football picture goes back to him. The cheerleader picture goes back to her. She gets the lavalier back. He gets the ring back. All of the other little trinkets that have been swapped, they go back. They break up. What has happened? We have had happen before us here a pseudo-divorce. This starts all over again. Fred gets him a squeeze. She gets her a dude. Starts all over. Picture swapped, eventually they break up. So that when you ultimately get married, and in these cases, usually who you marry is who you're dating at the time you are nubile. And they just happen to have that emotion going at the time. You can say, well, how about we get married? I got a job, I got a little income, got me a car. Why don't we get married? And then they stay married for about a year or two and decide, well, you know, this is just like high school. I don't love you anymore. Or, as George Strait says, I know she loves me, I just don't think she likes me anymore. And so that means you're calling Lou Basso. And Lou charges a lot more than what goes on in the high schools. So then there is a divorce. Why? Because we're used to it. We've been knocking these things out with no problem over the last several years. This is what you do. If you don't like each other, then call Lou. I don't mean to talk. I'm talking Lou out of business, possibly. I hope I am. He can get by. And the point is that this is embedding into the souls of young people an escape clause that's really not there. And that's where dating becomes dangerous. So if you have a daughter that dates, don't let her take a glossy 8x10 from anybody. No rings. No nothing. Because when you take the ring off, I can't get mine off. If you take the ring off and give it back, in essence, you've divorced. In the mind, it's a mental divorce. Solomon's erotic musings bore her. She's bored with the most famous man in the world at the time. She discerns his intentions and rejects them. Instead, she enters again into her memory center and recalls another treasured yet instructive moment with the shepherd. Every recall by her is designed to sustain her under pressure. She's going back and she's pulling something out of memory center here that is a treasured moment that goes south in a hurry. But it's instructive and helps her get through this moment. This sets up then another aria by the Shulamite that, except for a brief interruption by the virgins, continues to the end of the chapter. Now, this aria will give an account of another experience the Shulamite and shepherd have had together. The setting for the memory is the Shulamite's home in Shulam. Now, in Song of Solomon 2, verses 10 through 14, we observed a previous occasion where the Shulamite quotes the shepherd, and there we assign them a color code of brown. I assigned him, the shepherd, a color code of brown, and I'll do that again. So as you hold your colored printouts, you'll note in Song of Solomon 5:2 that the Shulamite introduces the verse. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. Now, this is a memory. Now, some of the commentators claim that this whole sequence we're entering into here is a dream. It's a daydream, but she's not asleep throughout this thing, and she's not dreaming anything as if it never occurred. This happened. She is relating an historical event, but it's in her memory. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Now, the shepherd lover speaks in her recall. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. I hope you'll note that he has a lot of possessive pronouns, too, directed toward her. He calls her my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. A right man has a right to say those kinds of things to his right woman. And you know from our study that they have identified each other as such. They actually are engaged, and therefore the reason they're not even married at this point is because the brothers have intervened. They're matchmakers, and they don't want this match to make. So, point one. Solomon's overly aggressive comments caused the Shulamite to once again retreat into her memory center, where she recalls an experience when she failed to respond properly to the shepherd's aggression and, as a result, placed herself into a dangerous situation. This recall enabled her to not make the same mistake again. She is in a position now to where passions and desires could very easily have been elicited by all of the things Solomon has said to her. And she does not need to react emotionally with the king of Israel. She can't go there. She is going to think back on a time where she reacted emotionally to the shepherd and things did not work out well at all for her. And so that is the gist of where we're going. Her memory center remembers a night when the shepherd came to her home and knocked on her door. Apparently, this occurred after he was banished from the estate, but before he was discovered by her brothers in Song of Solomon 2:15. Now, there's a sequence of events to where the shepherd and the Shulamite have a thing going. Let's say they're dating. But he takes her to a banquet house, as actually a wine house, properly translated. And the banquet house is where he proposed. Okay? And then the next thing we saw is when they were having a tryst in a stairwell. And that's where the brothers come in and catch him, and he's banished. And then the next thing we see is where she's running through the streets. This is chapter 3, verses 1 through 5 or 6, I think. and she's looking for him and finds him. So she finds him in the streets of Shulam, and takes her to see a mother. And that's where she announces the fact that she wants to marry this guy. So this is following protocol since her father is dead. Now, this actually occurs here. It's at this meeting where the mother is being introduced to the shepherd that the brothers come in and say, "We don't like this guy. We don't want you around our sister." And then he has to start sneaking in, and he sneaks in on this point and have this tryst here, and they're caught by the brothers. She's sent up to chase foxes out of the vineyard, and he is banished from the estate. So you have to follow this. These things do not happen sequentially because she's recalling things from her memory center. We had to piece that together, you remember. So, her memory center remembers the night when the shepherd came to her home and knocked on her door. Apparently this occurred after he was banished from the estate, but before he was discovered by the brothers in Song of Solomon 2:15. The Shulamite had retired for the evening, had gone to sleep, and was having dreams about her right man. Suddenly she is awakened by a voice and his knock on the door. Ignoring the danger of waking her brothers. See, the brothers don't want him there. They said, "We don't want you around our sister." But he wants to see her desperately. And so he decides to go under the cover of darkness. We'll learn in a little while it was raining, a very misty rain. And he arrives there soaked because he's had to come a long ways, but he desires to see her. He has passions and desires for her. She can't come see him. She's banished. She's not allowed to associate with him. If he's going to see her, he has to do it surreptitiously. Now, they're right man, right woman. They have decided to get married. The brothers are standing in the way. In the Jewish environment, since the father is dead, the brothers have the power to dictate who their younger sister can see and even who she can marry. So they're imposing their authority on her, and it is an irresponsible use of power. Now, ignoring the danger of waking her brothers, the shepherd says outside the closed door, "Open to me, my Jewess, my darling, my dove, my undefiled." All of those are true. He calls her, first of all, my Jewess. That means that they're both genetically Jews. And therefore, they're not violating tradition by going outside their race to marry. It was traditional for Jews to marry Jews. And then he calls her my darling. He didn't call her his wife. Called her his darling, which is a phrase that lovers use. My dove is another one. Terms of endearment, my undefiled. Now, all of these are terms of endearment. She is not only the right woman for his soul and his body, she is also the right woman genetically, since marrying within the race was the traditional custom, although not always followed. Now, we've run out of time, and we've got an excerpt here that's going to give you information on the custom of the day with regard to marriage within one's race. And we'll pull an excerpt on that and give you the data and then move on with our study. And we're approaching Song of Solomon 5:2. This is where we actually see the conversation. Well, actually, it's not a very long one. A couple of comments at the door. Time for tea and crumpets. It puts us back here at 10 till the hour.